Today is Friday, January 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Australia revokes the visa of Novak Djokovic again. One Melbourne fan says it's probably a good thing.
The booing from the crowd, the passionate fans on his side, I just think we could potentially be asking for trouble.
President Biden sends tools to fight COVID across the U.S. and urges Americans to use what experts say is the most important tool.
The single most important thing to determine your outcome in this pandemic is getting vaccinated.
Plus, Ukrainian websites are hit with a massive cyber attack. We'll have these stories and more next. After several Ukrainian websites were hacked overnight, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg condemned the attack and said NATO and Ukraine will enter into an enhanced cyber agreement that will include access to a NATO malware information sharing platform. The hackers posted a message on the site of the foreign ministry saying, "Be afraid and expect the worst." AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
While it's not immediately clear who was behind the attacks, they come amid heightened tensions with Russia after talks between Moscow and the West failed to yield any significant progress this week. A Ukraine government spokesman says the websites of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and a number of other government agencies are temporarily down, adding specialists are working on restoring them. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The Be Afraid message appeared in Ukrainian, Russian and Polish on the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry website. To gain some perspective on the cyber attack and a long week of diplomacy talks between the U.S., its NATO allies, and Russia, I reached out to Thomas Graham, a Russian expert with the Council on Foreign Relations. Graham says he does see a connection between the attack and the inability of the parties to reach a compromise, but he does not view the stalemate as a breakdown in those talks.
I don't think that the talks have necessarily broken down. They obviously didn't make a substantial amount of progress over the past week, but the decision as to whether to continue diplomacy or not is going to be made in coming days. That said, I do believe that there's probably a connection between the nature of the conversations in Europe over the past week and a cyber attack against government websites in Ukraine. Again, a way for Russia to demonstrate, if indeed they're behind these attacks, as I presume they probably are, that they have ways of ratcheting up the tension, making it clear that they're serious, that the United States has to engage on the question of eastward expansion of NATO.
Would you say that this week of, and it's been a long week of diplomacy talks, even if they haven't been all that successful, have they helped unify the U.S. and its NATO allies on their position about Russia?
I think that's absolutely true. The administration has worked very hard over the past weeks and months to rally its NATO partners and allies around a unified position in dealing with Russia. That was in display in Brussels on Wednesday of this week. I think it will continue. So the administration, I think, gets kudos for very good work in this regard.
When Biden was a senator back in the late 1990s, and he was the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, he even said that turning Cold War adversaries into allies would mark the beginning of another 50 years of peace. Those were his words. And then came the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, which went on for years. Now experts are saying Biden is not so eager to expand NATO. Is there a chance that NATO would accept Ukraine as a member in the very near future?
Well, the short answer to that question is no. I don't believe that there's any NATO official or American official who believes that Ukraine is ready for NATO membership. In fact, for the past decade or more, we've soft-pedaled that issue ever since, in fact, the Bucharest Declaration by NATO in 2008 that Ukraine and Georgia would become members of NATO. There's concern about the internal political situation in Ukraine, too much corruption for NATO membership. There are questions about its military capacity. And finally, there's the question as to whether Ukraine and NATO would in fact enhance the security of the Euro-Atlantic region or whether it would raise additional security concerns. So NATO membership for Ukraine is not on the table in the near future, certainly not in the coming year. I would argue probably not for a decade or more.
I've heard the argument that Putin is very strategic about this, and timing is very important, too, because Some believe that there's just a very small window of opportunity to do this now. One, because of the weather that's coming in Ukraine, and you can't advance thousands of forces in icy cold weather. There's any validity to that argument?
You know, I don't believe that a military incursion into Ukraine is Putin's first preference at this point. In fact, I would argue that what he wants is a diplomatic solution to this problem. He wants to maintain tension along the Ukrainian border as a way of persuading the United States that it needs to engage seriously on the concerns that Russia has raised, but specifically the eastward expansion of NATO. You know, my belief is that Putin is prepared to wait for some additional time to see whether the diplomatic track will work. If he decides that it isn't going in the right direction, then, as he said, he's prepared to use what they say military technical means to try to readjust the situation. That doesn't only mean a military incursion into Ukraine. That's what the West is focused on, what the media is focused on. But Russia has other options as well. Something that has surfaced quite just recently is the idea that Russia would build up its military infrastructure in places like Cuba and Venezuela, in a sense posing in an equivalent threat to the United States that Russia believes the United States opposes to Russia in Europe, resurrecting to some extent the Cuban Missile Crisis of several decades ago, and seeing whether that will force a change in U.S. negotiating position.
So in other words, you're saying like the Russians are going, well, if, you know, you think that this isn't a big deal for us, you know, how about if we come real close to your border and see how you like it?
That's exactly what I think the thinking in Moscow is. Let's create an equivalent threat to the United States, see whether you like it, see what you think about spheres of influence, and perhaps having experienced that firsthand, you'll be prepared to negotiate in a more serious fashion with us about our security concerns in Europe.
That was Thomas Graham with the U.S. think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking to me Friday from New York. On Monday, Graham talks about the chances of reaching a compromise in the talks on European security. Legal experts say U.S. prosecutors appear to have proceeded carefully in bringing sedition charges against 11 people linked to a far-right militia who took part in the deadly 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol and are likely to obtain convictions. An indictment was released on Thursday against the founder of a group called the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes. AP correspondent Gary Fields reports the charges of seditious conspiracy against Rhodes and 10 other members or associates marks a new phase in the investigation.
The big thing here is that this is a serious escalation of the seriousness and the level of charges in connection with January the 6th, and because it brings in conspiracy.
That was AP correspondent Gary Fields. Australia has canceled the visa of the world's number one tennis player, Novak Djokovic, on health and public order grounds. The Serbian player's lawyers are expected to challenge the government's decision in court. From Melbourne, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia Immigration Minister Alex Hawke said he'd cancelled Djokovic's visa on health and good order grounds on the basis that it was in the public interest to do so. He said his decision had been made after careful consideration of information provided by the Department of Home Affairs, the Australian Border Force and Mr. Djokovic. The tennis star had been granted a medical exemption from COVID-19 vaccination rules by two independent health panels organised by Australian tennis authorities and the Victoria State Government. However, he was detained when he arrived at Melbourne Airport January 5 by Australian Border Force officials. The cancellation of his visa was overturned by a federal court judge Monday. However, his visa has now been revoked for a second time. This tennis fan in Melbourne believes it was the right decision.
Oh, look, I think it's for the best. The more you think about it, the tensions that would have been there, the booing from the crowd, the passionate fans on his side, I just think we could potentially be asking for trouble, personally. Unfortunate as the whole saga is, I think it's the right decision and we can hopefully move on.
Djokovic said he'd contracted coronavirus last month, which gave him the right to apply for a medical exemption. However, Australian border authorities had said that the tennis star had not met immigration regulations. Djokovic has won the Australian Open title 9 times. Had he triumphed at this year's tournament, he would have become the most successful men's Grand Slam champion with 21 titles. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Melbourne.
You're listening to VOA News.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. What's behind Russia's unprovoked military buildup along Ukraine's borders? Is Russian President Vladimir Putin worried that Ukraine's affinity with the West and desire to adhere to the rule of law threaten his autocratic rule? We'll ask our guest, Bill Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, now vice president at the U.S. Institute of Peace. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including Americans are increasingly frustrated over long lines to get tested for COVID-19 and a shortage of testing kits for use at home. We'll have this topic and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Dam. U.S. President Joe Biden says he's ramping up the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic, distributing free face masks and a total of 1 billion home test kits amid the onslaught of the highly infectious Omicron variant. But health equity groups say flooding one country with tools won't fix the global pandemic and that the rest of the world needs help, too. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell has this report from Washington.
U.S. President Joe Biden said he's responding to the vicious Omicron variant by flooding his country with essential tools. On Thursday, he announced that Americans would get free face masks and 500 million more free home test kits, which is in addition to the 500 million previously announced. That means roughly that each person in America can now access 3 free test kits. Insured Americans, he said, can be reimbursed for 8 tests a month. But Biden continued to urge Americans to embrace what doctors say is the most important tool against the virus.
So the single most important thing to determine your outcome in this pandemic is getting vaccinated. If you're not vaccinated, join the nearly 210 million American people who are vaccinated. If you are vaccinated, join the nearly 80 million Americans who have gotten the booster shot with the strongest protection possible.
The current coronavirus surge, fueled by the Omicron variant, has now caused record hospitalization levels in the U.S. and around the world. The new variant was first reported in South Africa, and one of that nation's top scientists told VOA earlier this month that if the U.S. really wants to end the pandemic, it needs to think well beyond its own borders. Dr. Salim Abdul-Karim led South Africa's first COVID task force.
Africa should receive vaccines and should be able to achieve high vaccination coverage just like every other country, because we get infected just as much as everyone else. We get severe disease just as much as everyone else, and we die from COVID-19 just as much as everyone else. So we should get vaccines, and we should have the access to vaccines that we need.
Health policy advocates are quick to note that viruses exploit the unvaccinated to breed and create dangerous new variants. Tom Hart leads the One Campaign, a health policy advocacy organization.
If it is managed in the United States and unmanaged with half the planet that has no vaccines, you're going to see more variants. And every time this virus replicates itself, we're rolling the dice that it could be more transmissible or more deadly.
With more than 1 in 4 COVID tests now coming up positive in the U.S., the Biden administration now faces criticism for moving too slowly to meet this surge. The White House says it has made great efforts and great progress in keeping pace with the virus.
What we've been working to implement is building on the steps we've taken over the last 6 months and more. Remember, when the president took office, there were 0 or 1 approved testing, at-home testing option on the market. Now there are 9.
The Biden administration has pledged to donate 1 billion doses of vaccine to the world this year, and Biden has urged other wealthy nations to increase their vaccine donations. Because on one point, doctors agree the best way to answer that persistent question, when will this end, is when everyone, everywhere, gets protection. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
President Biden and Democratic lawmakers are maneuvering this week to break Senate rules to allow debate on key voting rights legislation that the Republican Party has blocked for months. The showdown is the culmination of a fierce debate over the democratic process. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
A final plea from the President of the United States. Joe Biden on Capitol Hill Thursday, making the case one more time for passage of a major voting rights bill.
As long as I have a breath in me, as long as I'm in the White House, as long as I'm engaged at all, I'm going to be fighting.
After months of failed attempts to pass the legislation in an evenly divided Senate, Biden encouraged Democrats to break the filibuster, a major rules change bypassing Republicans to open up the opportunity for debate. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
This is a historic chance to save our democracy, need to protect the fundamental form of American government. And his view is this should absolutely be bipartisan.
But the White House failed to convince Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who is the key Democratic vote needed for that change.
Eliminating the 60-vote threshold will simply guarantee that we lose a critical tool that we need to safeguard our democracy from threats in the years to come. It is clear that the two-party strategies are not working, not for either side, and especially not for the country.
Sinema's argument for compromise puts her in the company of Republicans, who argue breaking those Senate rules would be harmful to American democracy and repeatedly have blocked any attempts to debate voting rights. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
President Biden, Senate Democrats have been shouting, actually shouting at the American people that an evil, racist, anti-voting conspiracy will destroy democracy forever unless Democrats get total one-party control of the entire government starting next week.
But Democrats say this legislation comes at a crucial moment for the United States, as it would expand access to the ballot box for minorities, including African Americans, who have faced decades of discrimination and barriers to voting. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
If there was ever a power grab, it's what's happening in the state legislatures right now, where Republican legislators are taking away people's sacred right to vote and aiming it particularly at certain groups, people of color, young people, people in urban areas, older people, disabled people.
A variety of polls show many Americans broadly support the ideas in the voting rights legislation, but are divided along partisan lines when it comes to ending the filibuster. Democrats are expected to try and fail to make a rules change this weekend. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
North Korea has fired what is believed to be two short-range missiles. It's the third weapons launch this week in an apparent reprisal for fresh sanctions imposed by the Biden administration. North Korea launched a hypersonic missile test on Tuesday. South Korea's military says the latest missiles came from an inland area and landed in the sea. Italy, Spain, and other European nations are reinstating mask mandates as their hospitals struggle to keep up with rising numbers of COVID-19 cases. Other countries, such as the Netherlands, are considering introducing new mask rules. The use of more protective masks in Italy is also seen as a way to keep businesses running. Conservationists and veterinarians are warning that plastic waste in an open landfill in eastern Sri Lanka is killing elephants. Two more elephants were found dead over the weekend. Tests on the bodies of dead elephants shows that about 20 have died over the last 8 years after eating plastic trash in the dump. The African immigrant community in New York City is rallying behind victims of the Bronx apartment fire that killed 17 people and injured more than 60 others. Initial reports indicate the fire was caused by a malfunctioning space heater. Most of the victims, including 8 children, were from the West African nation of the Gambia. Robert Agaimong, New York director of African Communities Together, tells VOA's Jackson Mugagne that his group and other African diaspora organizations are raising funds to help the survivors.
The African community in the Bronx is a very strong and vibrant community. It's composed of many different communities in countries within Africa. You know, you have the Gambian community, you have the Nigerian community, the Ghanaian community, the Senegalese community, the Ivorian community, and so on. And so though it's known to be heavily populated by Western Africans, there's still other mixes of different countries within the community, which is why it's very important to recognize, even though some people outside of the community, they'll say the Africans, they might be referring to the Western Africans or mainly Nigerians because they're the most heavily populated there. But there's many, many other countries and
communities represented
in there.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk about this tragic fire. What is the history of this apartment and how does it come to have a large resident population of Gambian immigrants living in this particular building?
In this particular building, because it is a building within the housing complex that is within that neighborhood. Mm. And as the Twin Parks complex, it is a part of the NYCHA Housing Authority. And so this particular building is a building that is for as long as two decades and maybe even further going back, has been a place where a lot of the Gambian community has gathered and been able to find housing and been able to thrive and organize and gather. The communities that gather here, immigrant communities, usually when somebody gets to a place, they try to bring others along. And so sometimes a lot of people will gather in one apartment. And then when a person gets to a solid financial place, they'll try to find another apartment within the building and so on. They'll bring family over, or they'll hear about people coming and needing support. And then before you know it, this building is now a very highly populated Jamaican, community or Gambian community
or Nigerian.
Correct. It snowballs after people begin to gather.
What sort of help are you providing to the survivors and what are some of their urgent needs right now?
We as African Communities Together, we are working with some of the other organizations. We haven't been directly in touch with the Gambian Youth Organization yet, but we are setting up to begin to help them with coordinating a lot of these efforts. This kind of tragedy isn't something that one organization should be left to deal with on their own. This is for all of us to gather around. They must lead the charge because they work directly in that area. These are their people and we follow their lead, but we give the support that will enable them to ensure that their people are taken care of.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Doctors at the University of Maryland Medical Center recently performed a historic heart transplant. For the first time, a genetically modified pig's heart was successfully transplanted into a 57-year-old patient who was suffering from end-stage heart disease. The medical center reports that the patient, identified as David Bennett of Maryland, is doing well days after the operation. They say the patient will continue to be carefully monitored in the days and weeks ahead. A press release from the University of Maryland says that since doctors found the patient was ineligible for a conventional human heart transplant, using a pig's heart was the only available option. Mr. Bennett said in the press release, quote, "It was either die or do this transplant. I want to live," unquote. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
That's all we've got for you today. On behalf of Managing Editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the rest of the production team, thanks so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Have a great weekend, everybody, and stay safe.